Okay, so guys, the podcast is called Dying to Ask. It's not a strictly running podcast, but because I love running so much, I find a way to get runners in it a lot. So Lindsay's episode will probably be live on Monday. If you're dying for something to listen to tonight, I've got a great recent episode with Kim Conley, who is our local two-time, hopefully three-time, Olympic 5,000 meter runner. So if you want to like get amped up and hear how she's doing things, you can definitely do it. All right, Mason, are we ready to go?
Awesome.
You good?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, welcome to a live taping of the Dying to Ask podcast. We're coming to you live from the California International Marathon Expo. So can you guys make just a little bit of noise so people know that we've got like real people? Nice. I like it. Raising the bar here. So what is the Dying to Ask podcast? Well, it's a show where I interview people who have big ideas and then they actually pull it off. And I'm always fascinated by like kind of how they go from A to B. And our guest today is a perfect example of that. Her name is Lindsay Krause, and since 2011, she's been an editor, a writer, and a producer at the New York Times. She has written dozens of articles, essays, and produced op-eds and op-docs for the paper and its website. And among the ones you have likely watched, heard, or read, including The Shalane Effect, which was about female athletic success after Shalane Flanagan amazingly won the 2017 New York City Marathon. I still get chills thinking about that. With her op-doc, she has won two Emmys, two Peabodys, and has had two Oscar nominations. I've never had an Oscar-nominated person on this podcast. That's cool. She is the winner of the George Hirsch Journalism Award. It recognizes excellence in reporting and writing and broadcast. Oh, and she went to Harvard, where she ran cross-country and track. Oh, we're not done. She's even more amazing. She's aiming for an Olympic trials qualifying time tomorrow in CIM. Welcome, Lindsay Krause.
Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, we're so excited to have you. I mean, honestly, if you were really going for an Olympic trials qualifying time, you probably shouldn't have done all this viral work in the last couple of months, right?
Yeah, no, I've had a kind of that realization in the past couple of days when I was, or maybe weeks, when I was trying to figure out exactly what pace I can do. And I mean, the hard thing about improving your marathon time is that it gets harder and harder with each go. And my best time is at 2:57, so I'm trying to bring it down by 12 minutes. I think at this point, I'm going to be lucky if I hit a 2:49, but still for me, that'll
still be an amazing time, right?
Yeah,
that's great. Have you found that with all the attention that your work has gotten in the last couple of months, in some ways that's been helpful for training? Because I know being a mom and working, my multitasking is like off the hooks these days. And sometimes it's kind of nice to be able to not have to stress about the working out part.
Yeah, I do have this theory where you can kind of do like three things at any given time. And I think you're better off when you are kind of doing those three things and they balance each other out a little bit. I think the challenge is when one starts to take up all the work and you're still trying to do those other two things. And I think for me, work did kind of get that way as a few of my articles got much more widely read than I expected. But at the same time, running has always been a really nice balance for me to work and to social things and everything else.
Clear your head a little bit too,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about your job at the New York Times, because what's so interesting to me is you've gotten so much attention for the articles and the stuff you've been working on lately, which all have this women's sports theme. But you're not a sports writer. You don't actually work technically in the sports department.
Yeah, I mean, I think like a lot of women who are interested in things that, you know, may not necessarily have a precedent for in terms of an audience or, you know, people deciding that they want that to be written for them. I just kind of stumbled on all this by accident. And I think my athletic arc has really tracked with the rise of a lot of women's athletic success. And so I work at the Times and I've always loved writing and I started noticing all these things and, you know, I have access to the editor. So I just started pitching them on topics that really interested me without necessarily people at the Times like knowing that there was an obvious audience for this. And
right.
Then I think everyone was really surprised when they did sometimes become some of the most like commented on, most read, most discussed articles, because I think there is something about running where running and sport in general where it can kind of break through and it's not just a sports article. It's about gender, it's about female success, it's about leadership, and I think those are the things that I really see in athletes, and I'm able to kind of translate through my writing.
So is your job basically to find things that people are going to want to talk about?
I wouldn't say that's my job, but I would say that's my passion. And
well, what do your bosses say your job is? What do they pay you for, Lindsay?
Yeah, so what I'm paid for at work is actually to develop that documentary series. I've had sort of an entrepreneurial experience at the times where, and since I've been there, starting in 2011, it has become, for an institution that is as sort of established as it is, it's become a place where if you can kind of figure out where the gaps might be, there is an opportunity to be entrepreneurial there. And I think in some ways that's where the highest reward is. I've always approached my career as like, of course you have your job, but don't just do your job, try to do extra. And so I started there as an assistant in I think 2011, Jody Cantor actually, who wound up doing all that Weinstein reporting, what was that, 2 years ago at this point, kind of started the Me Too movement. I was her research assistant, just on the side from another job actually, that I had.
Were you researching Weinstein?
No, we were. I was her research assistant on a book about the Obamas and their marriage, and that was her first book. And so I think it's important actually to remember that, and I think you could look at my career this way as well, that when you see someone suddenly appear successful, there's often a lot of kind of accidents behind that, or not necessarily accidents, but kind of a seeing where the gaps are, seeing what interests you, pursuing that, and then one thing builds to another, often just kind of like on the side. I don't think people necessarily, like I don't think with Jody, she didn't show up at the Times being like, I'm gonna take down Harvey Weinstein. And I didn't come to the Times saying, I'm gonna become a reporter who's writing about the intersection of sort of feminism and sport. But you can kind of, you see where your green lights are and you pursue those. And I think that's what I've done, that's what she did. But at the same time, so she, when I was her research assistant, she found an assistant job for me at the Times, and that's how you get those jobs, is like by kind of building up a network, and you can only find those jobs by someone introducing you to them. And so it happened for me like a lot later after college than a lot of other people who had those networks already established for them. But so she kind of pushed me forward. She was like, you should do this. So I came to the Times, and you know, it's one of those assistant jobs where there was an expiration date on it. There was like a 2-year kind of like up or out, and then most people had to leave. But I didn't want to. I wanted to stay. I wanted to do something different. But I didn't know what that was. No one could really tell me. And so I guess I just followed what interests me and kind of what wasn't really being written about. I'd never really thought the sports pages were written for someone like me. And then the longer I was there, I was like, I'm the only like still somewhat competitive athlete at this company. So of course I should be paying attention to the sports pages. I mean, a lot of athletes age out after college, like that's totally normal, but with running, it's really a beautiful thing that you can still pursue that. Now there are a number of other competitive runners there, but I've really followed the sport this whole time, and there's so much, I think, that isn't really being written about it, and so much that we can kind of, so many insights that we can see about society and kind of what our values are that we should be paying attention to, that really shine through the sport, and so I did see an opportunity there to kind of be a translator for those issues.
I love that, because it's the idea of being an intrapreneur within a very established organization. But your organization has also evolved so much, because
Absolutely.
The digital part of what the Times does through its daily podcast and the video series set the bar in journalism, which mm-hmm. I think is just incredible. Mm-hmm. All right, so let's talk to the one in the last month that I don't even know how many times people have watched this video you put together about Mary Kane, but for people who are not familiar with who Mary Kane is and her story, how did this come about?
Yeah, so, I guess the long way of saying it is that since I am a video producer at the Times, in addition to doing some of this reporting, earlier this year I worked on a story with Alicia Montaño, who I think was here, and it was about kind of shining a light on whereas female athletes are publicly praised and have been by their sponsors, especially recently, as combining a motherhood and a successful athletic career, even at the Olympic level, has become more common, people weren't really talking about the private challenges that they faced. In many cases, almost financial punishment from their sponsors. They had no protection and often faced major pay cuts, for perhaps more than a year, if you think about how long maternity lasts.
Because most of them are contract workers,
exactly.
Basically.
All of them are. Yeah, and that, of course, that speaks to broader social issues in America, but so much about running and the reporting that we're doing now does. It's like, but America loves its Olympians, and so it was kind of like, what if we use these champions who America claims to cherish and actually talk about the challenges that they face? Well, of course, the metaphor is that so many women around the country are facing this in America, like these kinds of challenges. Why don't we talk about this? Again, these are the legal things that in many ways society is totally okay with, but why don't we just really show people what these women are going through? And so we did that with Alicia. It was called Dream Maternity. It was a video that we published in on Mother's Day, actually. And I wasn't really sure if anyone was going to care because, again, these things are totally legal. But it wound up starting a major conversation. And then from there, Allison Felix, the most decorated athlete in track and field history, she was undergoing those issues like right then. And so she had been a major source on all this, obviously off the record. And then she decided that she wanted to come forward. And I think the combination of those voices together with Kara Goucher, just they were explosive and they really started a national conversation. Fast forward to September when Alberto Salazar, the most famous coach at Nike, which is obviously the most influential sponsor in track and field, when he received his ban for doping right around the World Championships, one of his most talented teenage runners ever, or most promising runners, Mary Kane, who was the fastest girl in America when she ran with Nike back in 2016, she decided that she wanted to come forward with her experience with him and with Nike, which again involved totally legal, totally mainstream issues such as like pressure to lose weight, which like you're super lucky if you're a female athlete and you've never faced that kind of pressure. But
you're kind of a unicorn.
Yeah, I mean, you're just lucky. And I think, so she wanted to talk about how running with him as a teenager, she faced extreme pressure to lose weight.
She was 16, 17?
Yeah, 16, 17, 18, 19. I think she was 18 when she actually moved out there. So she was college age, but she was running as a professional. I think she was the youngest athlete to turn professional in track and field ever. And so she was studying at university out there, but training with Nike and training with Salazar.
So Mary reached out to you.
Yeah. So she, after she saw what we did, particularly with Allison Felix, who, if you think about it, Allison was like an idol to Mary. She was like maybe 10 years older or something. She saw what Allison did and she was like, I want to do that too. I want to talk about my story. And so...
How did she do it? Did she send you an email?
Alexi Pappas connected us.
Okay.
I'd done something with Alexi earlier that year. And so Alexi she called me, actually missed the call, and she was like, I just want to connect you with Mary. And I was a little worried because she didn't tell me what Mary wanted to say. And I thought maybe Mary wanted to talk about how great her time with kind of defend Salazar in a way to kind of like... Some athletes had struggled with their associations with Salazar, and I thought maybe that was what she wanted to do. And I was like, that's fine. That would work for the sports pages. Like, that might work for Runner's World, depending on what she wants to say, but it wouldn't work for New York Times opinion, where if we are going to spotlight the story of an athlete, it really needs to break through. It really needs to say something beyond just sports. And I love those stories, and I love to work with athletes to tell those stories, but the core of what they want to say needs to be able to go there. I wrote back to Mary after Lexi connected us. I wrote back to her right away and was like, okay, what do you want to say? And it took her, I think, 2 days to tell me. And so that was over a weekend. I think we were in touch at 11 p.m. on a Friday night or something. And then I was like, okay, tell me, but without wanting to put too much pressure on her. And
is it important that the people that you profile can verbalize it themselves before you start on a project with them?
Well, you just need to know what they want to say. And I think in Mary's case, she actually still wasn't totally sure what she wanted to say.
Yeah.
It was so sensitive for her. And obviously as a teenager, she faced so much scrutiny. And of course, I mean, you've got to remember, Mary was a really promising athlete, but at this point, she really faded from the scene. Like, she's coaching Mile High Run Club in New York. A lot of people had forgotten about her. When she finally did tell me what she wanted to say, which again, is sort of a Rorschach test for whether or not you think this is serious, I was really astounded by just how seriously people took what she was saying. But again, it's like, it's also credible.
Right. So what is the process? Once you decide, yes, we're going to do this piece together, how do you work with the person and what is your role? And then we'll talk a little bit about what she actually went on to say in the video.
Absolutely. So she came to me and she had, she first wrote out her thoughts in text. And I think she maybe wanted to do an op-ed, and I really wanted to kind of help her to do more. And I think that the amazing thing that we're doing in opinion video at this point, at the Times, is letting people kind of tell their stories in their own words, but we're stylizing it so that people can to kind of heighten whatever emotional through line they're trying to get across.
Okay, so break that down. What does that mean?
So she wanted to talk about her experience at Nike, but we needed to introduce an audience, not like the people here, many of whom probably had heard of her, but like sort of like the average Times reader. And the way I think about it when I'm doing these women's sports stories is I'm like, what do I want, like Michelle Obama, for example, to get out of this story? Like, chances are she's going to see it. She's not a track and field athlete, but she understands women, and she understands girls, and she's a champion of girls. So how do I, and that's like when I'm thinking with an athlete about how to kind of break down their story, I'm always thinking like, for example, Michelle Obama, like what do I want her to take away from this? So first we had to set up who Mary is, and I think, and so I was trying to like come up with these catchphrases like, But they all have to be true. So like it started with I was the fastest girl in America, and then we just pause, and like that somehow helped people really understand like who she was.
This is so inside to just TV people, but the pause was perfect.
Yeah,
it was like there's a you can do too long a pause, and you can definitely do too short a pause, but you nailed it because it was just enough time to go, huh?
Absolutely.
Who is she?
Yeah.
I don't remember her.
Yeah, and so that was actually my co-producer, Alex Stockton, or Alexander Stockton, who is just a genius. He just came to us from Vice News Tonight, and he is really, really a genius at just kind of like that editing, like those editing beats. And so we scripted it together, and he's actually really great to work with. I work with a lot of guys in Opinion Video, and they were actually perfect foils because they don't know anything about this either. And so the messaging, we were able to kind of like bounce it all off. Like I understand the story vividly, but it was really important to get people who didn't to also care. And I think that's what we were able to do with sort of this like kind of motley crew of producers now that we have an Opinion Video. It's a team of like six people.
So interesting. Okay, so she starts off, she says, I was the fastest runner. Then what?
And then I think we had her say, I broke many national records, just to help her understand that, you know, she was a historically successful runner. And then I was a straight-A student, and now we're trying to cue into, like, this is like when every father in America is like, that's the daughter I want. Like, every parent in America is like, oh, okay, I'm paying attention now. Like, she's perfect. And then she talks about how she went to Nike, and you're kind of like having everyone ride this high with her. And then she talks about when she went to Nike, about how she started to decline, and about why. And that's because...
And you can't think of a more iconic brand in America. I mean, Nike, everybody knows Nike. They know the slogans, they know the feeling, they know it.
Well, also what they know, and this is why we even started doing this. Like, I personally, nothing against Nike, I love Nike's marketing. Nike's marketing, I deeply believe in. That's why we did the thing with Alicia Montano. I love their ad with Serena about how women can combine, like, do crazy things. Like, I love the idea of dreaming crazy, but you can't market that unless you're following through. And in the same way, I love the Girl Effect, their marketing campaign back in 2006 when I think I graduated from college. I was really, really believing in the idea of sports companies using their mission and using their message to uplift girls. And I think, and like, that's that. And I think whenever you realize that you're buying something and you're buying into a brand partly because of these things that you really value, realizing that in practice it's not necessarily always working out that way, I think it's important to kind of to highlight those disparities. And so that's what we were doing there. So anyway, when Mary was at Nike, she faced a lot of the pressures that a lot of girls and young women, and even older women all over the country face in terms of pressure to diet, to the point where she lost her period. And then I thought everyone knew this, but apparently they don't. If you lose your period when you're a girl or a woman, your bones start to deplete in terms of their calcium, their strength, and you start to get stress fractures, then your career starts to really suffer, and it can take years to come out of that.
And that's the part in the video where it gets dark.
Absolutely.
Because she starts bulleting out all of this stuff.
Yeah, and she's so knowledgeable about that stuff. And I think what we really wanted to educate people as well, and that was really important to her. And so we were able to kind of talk about the challenges that she faced, but then also talk about how this extends to many girls around, many young women, and even boys around the country, boys and young men. And then finally she gives some prescriptions at the end because her coaches were all men. And it's not to say that men are bad and women are good. There are plenty of bad women coaches. There are plenty of amazing male coaches. But you do have to wonder if there were women that she could have gone to, maybe could she have not declined to the extent that she did.
How, and when you talk about the decline, what were the realities of that for her?
She just started to really fail. And I think parts of it were physical. She also says that a lot of it was mental. She started using a scale to assess whether or not she was ready to race, and that's what her coaches were basically telling her to do. And I think, she said she would show up to a starting line knowing that she'd already lost because the number on the scale wasn't what her coaches said it should be. And I find that extremely believable. If you don't believe that you can win, how are you supposed to win? And any runner who's lived into a couple decades of doing it knows that your times aren't dependent on those numbers, that race weight is kind of a construct, I guess. It's great to have targets, it's great to have things to shoot for, but a specific number is just unrealistic. And
how long was that video?
7 minutes.
7 minutes. You guys released the video, and then what happened?
It blew up. We published it at 5 a.m., I think, and I've never seen traction on anything that I've done before, and I have gotten a lot of traction on things that I've done before. This one just took off right away. It was ricocheting around the internet. I was absolutely astounded. My inbox started filling up. Hers, she was totally overwhelmed. It was the night before. I felt kind of bad because I was like, she really wanted to publish it earlier. She wanted to time it to a marathon, and I felt like we should have waited and tried to drive a news cycle, especially after the Chicago Marathon and the New York City Marathon had died down, because there's always a news cycle around those marathons. But at the same time, I didn't want to overpromise, because you just never know. Again, everything that she was saying happened is so normal that who's to say people are going to care? And so I was trying to tell her to wait, but at the same time, I was like, if this doesn't break through, I'm going to feel awful, because this girl has decided, or this young woman has decided she wants to tell her story, and I'm having her wait for a number of weeks. I can't remember how long. And I think in the end, it was great, but the night before, I was like, so we're going to publish this. Try to prepare yourself, but I also can't guarantee that it's going to go well. And then it was like, then it was so widely read that her phone started blowing up, obviously, and I think it was just... I was like, you have a boyfriend, have your boyfriend manage this for you. You can't handle this right now. It's not fair.
Did your bosses expect this thing to do well?
No. I think they were really, really astonished. And
did they get it? You knew.
Yeah.
Because you'd had similar experiences, a lot of female runners. But, I guess what I love is that there were very low expectations,
yes.
Which sometimes as a journalist is a really great place to be.
Yeah.
Because you can only impress people then.
Well, of course.
You know?
I've benefited a lot from that at the times. It's like, it's not my job, so I can only succeed, really, and I think that's really wonderful. But another thing that we did was, at first, Mary wanted to keep it, very close to her, and then I ultimately was like, you have these other women that I've worked with, these other Olympians, who I know you can trust, if you want to talk to them ahead of time. And I think getting Lauren Fleshman, getting Kara Goucher, connecting with a few other women ahead of time, actually, and having them kind of on her side to begin with so that they could speak out immediately and kind of amplify her message. I think that was really powerful, because historically there hasn't been a lot of athletes necessarily speaking up on behalf of others. I think Shalane Flanagan has been an amazing starter of that movement, particularly with her team at Bowerman, but there isn't a lot of kind of intra-team support for each other all the time. And with this, it was like everyone, you were either saying nothing or you were speaking up in favor of Mary. And I thought that was really wonderful, because with the maternity stuff, there was a lot of discussion, I think really healthy discussion, but not everyone was on the same page about it. And I think with this, there was a pretty collective idea that we need to support girls, because otherwise we extinguish their talent. Who wants that? It benefits no one. I thought that was really wonderful.
So how many times has this video been watched?
On the Times, a ton, and then on YouTube, 7 million alone. So
7 million times?
Oh, sorry, it actually might be 6.5 million, sorry.
It's a rounding error.
Yeah,
you're good.
Sorry, yes.
That is amazing.
Yeah, it's insane.
So let's talk about the discussion that's come out, because there were, you mentioned super impressive other female athletes who came out. And what I loved about them, because I actually was watching that morning, because I get up at 2:15. So when you publish something, yeah, I know. When that stuff comes out, I'm reading it as it's coming out.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And so I was, you know, one of the first people to see it. I'm like, this is amazing, because as an Olympic reporter, I've covered 10 Olympics. Mm-hmm. I remember Mary Kane because she was on my list of people to follow. And then she was gone.
Right.
You know, so I'm like, oh, gone. Didn't really know why.
Right.
Until then.
Yeah.
So it was really interesting to see that. But of course, all these others like Lauren Fleshman and Shalane Flanagan coming out, that gave instant credibility. But what I found so interesting about their discussions is that they had, for the most part, all been through similar things. But the reality is, it was kind of the norm.
Yeah.
And so you don't question things a lot of times, and we definitely saw this with Me Too, because it doesn't occur to you that something is a problem.
Yep.
It's just what we do.
Absolutely, and I think that's what's been, for me, just astounding and so rewarding about everything that I've been able to do at the Times this year, is that everything that we've kind of shine a light on is totally legal. And it's also, it mirrors and amplifies the same issues that American women are facing all around the country. And so if I think just kind of using Olympians to talk, or just our America's best talent, America's best girls, our best women in this arena has, if we start a conversation with them and it's not okay for them, why is it okay for anyone? And I think that they really feel that way, and I certainly feel that way. So it's really been wonderful to see that people do think that this is not okay and we need to do something.
Let me play devil's advocate a little bit, because I did talk to a male coach who has coached Olympians, who said, one of the realities is that men and women, weight does play a factor in performance. So it's not, to the average person out there, you go, well, yeah, you shouldn't be having people starve themselves to be a certain weight. But there is a link between being fit and weight and performance that you can't completely ignore. But it does make it difficult sometimes to have these conversations.
Well, absolutely.
Is that a fair criticism?
Of course, and that's what my colleague said as well. I think the issue is when you tell someone to hit a number and you don't tell them how, and especially when they're younger, how is a teenager supposed to know how to healthfully get to that number that you want her to get to? Also, how did you come up with that number? I think weights are different on a lot of people, and everyone who's run with Salazar says that those numbers were totally arbitrary, like they were just coming up with them. So I think there's that issue, and then there's also the issue of course, no support. And then the third issue is that it didn't work. And so when it didn't work and she started to, her performances started to decline, they blamed her and not them. I think that's the most ridiculous part of all of that. And I think that's something that also mirrors society in a lot of ways, is that if you have certain people in power and no one's questioning them, why are they ever going to question themselves? And then we just forget about the people that wind up as collateral for those decisions. And we never actually, you know, stop or check the power of the person who's responsible for those declines.
Mm-hmm. There's also the issue of men and women are very different. And you talk about the ages when most of these people are peaking, and they're teenagers, and their bodies are not developed yet. So I feel like this has opened up a really good conversation about that for a lot of people.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's something that I absolutely think about when I think about myself. I struggled with this. I mean, my pressure was just internal. Like, I got into college and was like, okay, I really gotta, like, what I lack in talent, I need to make up with discipline.
Which is interesting. Go into that a little bit, because you got into Harvard, you got early acceptance on that. So then what I've read is that you kind of found yourself with a lot of time then, because you didn't have to worry about trying to get into a dream school.
Well, and academically, I was just so tired. And I was also just so nervous. I loved running, and I really wanted to know that I could run in college, but I was scared of a D1 Ivy League school, because it's really competitive for female distance running, for all the same issues that we're just talking about. Like, the girls that are good at school are really good at distance running, because it's about that hard work, that dedication, and they put it into their school, and they put it into their running, and they're just great at it. But, I was from Rhode Island, which is a good state, but, I was always very good in it, but I was never the best. And the other challenge is that I was never really racing against the other girls around the country. And so I was just kind of staying in Rhode Island. And so I was like, and Harvard was also kind of a metaphor for that, where I was like, okay, you've got to keep up. In some ways I'm kind of glad that I did try to have that, I guess, like, quote unquote discipline then, and kind of see that it wasn't a good idea, because I never tried it again. I knew it wasn't the right way to, I learned that it wasn't the right way to go about it. But then I did deal with that cycle of broken bones and just like kind of general not liking the sport as much for a little bit. College was really hard for me after that, from a running perspective, because it takes you a little while to recover. And I also think all girls, well, most girls, not all, but you do slump at some point. And I think it's important when that does happen to realize that you'll come out of it. But I don't know if every girl tells herself that and then waits to see if she comes out. I wonder if she just kind of writes herself off. And I'm really glad I didn't do that with myself, because I'm hoping to run a time that I never thought I could even approach tomorrow. And no matter what, my practices show that I can do it. So even if it doesn't go that way, I still feel that satisfaction. But I had to like believe in myself enough to try to do that again. And I think a lot of girls, no one tells them that there's another shot after they have those peaks and valleys.
They must have made your conversations with Mary as you scripted the video and executed it that much more relatable for her, because you really got it.
Yeah. I mean, you don't need to talk about yourself that much when you I always want when I work with a subject to have it be about them for sure. But
they know by the questions you ask them.
Yeah,
if
absolutely.
You really truly understand
yeah.
it.
Yeah. And there's no way that I didn't understand that. You know, I'm friends with enough runners. Like, it is my scene in so many ways that I think it's really great to have. It's such a privilege to be able to help tell those stories in a way that I do connect with. Like, to tell the stories that, like, everything that I'm doing right now is the kind of stuff that when I was in high school, I wish was around for me to have read or to have seen, or, you know, just to kind of know that stuff. And I think a lot of the athletes that I'm working with right now feel that way, and I do hope that we're leaving a legacy where, you know, girls have a little bit more information and support as they kind of start down this path as well.
See, and I love that, because the video is something that any coach can share now, and from the time a kid is, like, I coach middle school cross country. What a great thing to be able to show
Absolutely.
Them. These are things you need to know, because they might encounter a coach who doesn't know. Sometimes you don't know what you don't know,
yeah.
you know? So it at least arms them with the information on questions to ask and why something maybe is not a good idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, again, to me, that is the most important part of all of this, is it is such a privilege to be able to hope that the work that I'm doing right now spares other girls from maybe having to learn this stuff, like, I guess for lack of a better way of putting it, like, the hard way or by accident. To just understand so much for me, even in seeing, like, some of the athletes that were a few years older than me, like Shalane, like Lauren Fleshman, like Kara Goucher, seeing what they're going through right now, I'm like, okay, like, they, you know, our careers all go the way they go, and it's always okay. And I think that's been just really, it's just nice to have these dialogues out there. I think before, people were all kind of smiling and maybe suffering behind their smiles, mm-hmm. and I think that, or disappearing, and I think that it's really wonderful that you can, even when your times aren't necessarily where you want them to be, or your career from an athletic perspective is over, now those women can still stay in the sport. Like, for example, Shalane with coaching, with Lauren Fleshman with being on the governing body and just kind of being a really vocal influencer in the sport, with Kara Goucher the same. I think that's so meaningful, and I think it's really wonderful also to be able to pave the way for an athlete like Mary to have the same opportunity.
So what's come her way since this thing came out, other than, you know, her boyfriend having to take over the phone to spare her a little of it? But what's been the result of 7 million people now looking at this and starting this national conversation about it?
I think it's tremendously empowering to have a girl like that being able to, it shows that you can't mess with girls like that. Like, they don't just disappear anymore. She has more power than I think people realize she was going to, and I think that's really important. I'm sure she'll write a book. Like, that was actually the hardest thing about working with her, was everything that she was saying. It was like, okay, well, we can't include this in this piece because it's just not the right forum, but, like, this belongs in your memoir. And I think that's really cool. But I also think her story obviously isn't over yet. She's still a really great runner. She's a lot better now, I think, and I'm so curious to see how, after kind of having this off her shoulders, how she'll do athletically, you know, especially with the Olympics coming up and the trials,
yeah.
which, as far as, you know, last time I spoke with her, she's still going to try to go for that.
What is she running now? What distances is she doing?
The last I asked her what she's planning on racing, I don't want to speak for her because I'm sure it's evolving, but the 1500 and the 5K.
Yeah.
And she's just really fast, so it's great. And I think her workouts are going even better now, so that's wonderful. But yeah, I'm sure she'll write a book. I think she's just really trying to position herself as someone who girls can learn from, and who's a real advocate for girls. And I think she's in a perfect position for that. And I think everyone's really going to benefit from that.
Alberta Salazar is now facing a ban. Nike projects pretty much blown up. Nike's made some management changes. Did you hear from Salazar? Have you ever talked to him?
Yeah, I reached out to him before the piece, and
how does that conversation go?
It was via email. Nike didn't respond with comment. They only responded with comment after the piece, and he responded before, and he just said that he always had Mary's best interests in mind, and you know, if he weighed her, I think in some ways he kind of massaged the truth. Like he said, if he weighed her, it was to monitor dehydration. Like, you don't get dehydrated if you're a miler, like it to the point where your weight necessarily needs to be monitored. But he did say that he only had her best interest in mind, and I actually do believe that. I think this is sort of his story is an example of, again, why you can't just have these like cult-like personalities making decisions unchecked, and why you need a diversity in coaching.
And best interest for a coach, especially at that level with somebody who has that kind of a name, best interest equals winning.
Absolutely.
Right?
But if he'd accomplished that would have been great, but it didn't work out that way anyway. So
right.
Again, when she started to fail, he lost interest. And
have you ever met him?
No.
So I have, number of times. The last time I saw him was actually in 2012 at the London Olympics, and he had just written his memoir.
Okay.
And he is a very, very charismatic person.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting. I can see why so many people, I mean, obviously, like, if you were coached by Salazar, you were being coached by what was perceived by many to be the best the best program.
Yeah.
And why would you question things? Because this is the place where they make winners.
Well, especially now, you know? When you're a teenage girl.
No.
And yeah, I think that's what's most dangerous about the whole thing is that charisma and commanding presence does not necessarily equal all the right answers, and certainly not all the right answers for everyone. And you know, one approach isn't necessarily right for everyone. And I do just wish that the experience that comes out of Mary Kane's story could be applied, you know, really broadly, and say, like, if something isn't working for someone who clearly has a lot of talent, talent doesn't go away. So what should you change about the approach to actually, you know, make the talent continue to succeed?
Great lesson in there for parents too.
Absolutely.
Of talented kids.
Yeah.
Because as much as people love an underdog, we love a child prodigy even more.
Mm-hmm.
We really do.
I know. And that's why I knew Mary's story. That's like why I was like, the grades need to be in there. She's not just a great athlete. She's a great all-around student. She's a golden child that everyone would want to have. No one likes America's, like, people care about girls in this country and they want to protect their American girls, and she's an example of someone who was not protected. And I thought that was an important lesson for people to hear. She can't just disappear. We need to hear what happened to her and make some changes.
So what's happening for you these days? Like, when you hit 7 million downloads on a video, does that change what you do?
Yeah, I mean, when I first started at the Times, all I wanted was just to have, like, more, kind of, to not just be an assistant. And now it's like I just have, like, there's so much that I can do in a way that's really, really exciting to me. I finally just have, like, more on my hands than I can handle, which is exciting but also tiring. So I think going into next year, I'm gonna work with my colleagues to do some priorities. Like, I certainly want to keep doing this, and just kind of like changing this narrative around sport and around gender. And I think there's so many things that we can learn from athletes and how America looks at them, particularly at the intersection of like diet and fitness. I think running and racing are a terrific antidote to that, just in terms of like empowering ourselves through sport as opposed to like diminishing ourselves through exercise. I think that's a really important counter-narrative that isn't necessarily presented to women all the time, and I'd love to continue to do that at the Times. I think it's Times readers and readers all over the world really need to be hearing those messages and those options. And I love my documentary franchise, OpDocs. It's tremendously successful right now, and I just want that to keep going. And then Opinion Video itself is this kind of new flourishing forum for storytelling in a different way. And at the New York Times, that's a really, really exciting frontier to be on.
Is Opinion Video fact-checked? like yeah. it is. I'm curious to know about that part of it.
I fact check a lot of the videos there. Well, anything that I work on, I fact check. With Mary's case, for example, with Alicia's, it was actually, like, with the Dream Maternity, I actually effectively did, like, an entire investigation. Like, that wasn't, like, fact checking, that was writing the script and giving it to her and saying, read this, please. And I had to make sure that everything in her story continued to characterize an industry, which was really hard to do because it involved getting people to break their NDAs to kind of talk about issues that they could get sued for, that they were supposed to keep private. So that was really difficult. With Mary's case, I had to talk to a lot of other people to cross-verify what she was saying and kind of protect her from not going too far. Like, you can't embellish when you do those, when you do that kind of thing. And I knew enough to... The worst case scenario is always like, I mean, the test is always, what if this were on the front page of the New York Times? Like, would you be...
Which is always kind of ironic when you work at the New York
right,
Times.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so I was like, in this case, like, if we get as much promotion for this as I want it to get, think about it that way and have no surprises. And so I was reporting around it, which was difficult because I didn't want to... didn't want to give away her story, and not everyone agreed with her story. Like, some of it was like he said, she said, so yeah. It was like just stripping her story down to like the basic fundamental facts, and those weren't contestable, so that was fine.
If I was your boss, I'd be like, you got another one of those slurping back there, what else you got?
Yeah. No, I mean, we're gonna do something, we're gonna continue to work on this year. Like, we'll definitely do something on coaching. I'm really interested in sort of the NCAA and sort of vestiges of reforms that led to equality in women participating in sports, but triggered perhaps inequalities and or more men leading sports like coaching than women necessarily. And I want to kind of get into that a little bit more and kind of put pressure on maybe like the NCAA to really try to find more female coaches and more female athletic directors rather than just have it be this open secret like so many other things. So that's, again, like everything that I've been doing is things that we all know are true. It's just about framing and kind of making people not be able to ignore it.
Well, and starting a dialogue.
Absolutely.
And actually starting them talking about things,
yeah,
which
yeah.
is huge. Yeah. All right, well, best of luck tomorrow. You
oh,
feeling
thank
good?
You. I hope so. I mean, I'm not excited about this rain.
It's not that bad.
I'm hoping Sacramento's getting it all out of its system right now. it's not that bad for sure. So I had a really schizophrenic training cycle. It was like, just with all the kind of unexpected work, and then the
unexpected
stress.
Viral video in the middle of
yeah,
it.
Yeah, that really did trigger a fair amount of stress because, you know, Mary didn't have a staff, so I was trying to help her, but not tell her what to do.
Yeah.
And also to follow the story. I mean, you never know with something like that, if it does get that popular, what the outcomes are going to be. And kind of course, I wanted to help advance the story and keep the dialogue going. It was quite exhausting and quite stressful. I had to drop out of a workout. I had to do another, and then it was the New York City Marathon as well. So I was just busy in New York doing that. I helped cover it for the sports desk.
Well, here's the beauty of the race tomorrow. All you got to do is run.
Yeah.
And no one's bugging you during the marathon.
Yeah, no, that's true.
Just go enjoy the run and
yeah.
do your best and,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
and hopefully you get what you're looking for at the end of it.
Yeah, no, I hope so.
All right, Lindsay, what's a good way for people to follow you on social or?
Just my name. So I'm on Instagram and Twitter at just Lindsay Krause, at Lindsay Krause. And it's LindsayCrouse. And yeah, pretty findable.
And then on the New York Times, just doing a search on your name will pull up all those great videos
yeah.
and the articles.
Yeah.
Make sure you subscribe to the New York. Can I just tell you, New York Times is the best deal ever in
oh,
terms of
absolutely.
Subscribing. It's like $1, $2 a week, and
yeah.
what you get will keep you busy all week long.
Oh, of course. Yeah, it's great deep dives. Absolutely.
Oh, it's a rabbit hole.
Yeah.
Man, I can kill it.
Yeah, it's
afternoon.
Not just news.
No,
yeah.
so
it
much.
It makes you really smart.
It does make you smart.
Yeah.
I agree. Okay, so quick shout out real quick to my fellow podcaster, Matt Chittum of the Rambling Runner podcast. Matt is a former Dying to Ask guest, and he was actually supposed to be here with you today taping
yeah.
this show.
Yeah.
Matt had to drop out, and I'm just going to tell you, this is the best sloppy seconds I've ever gotten. So Matt, thank you so much for, not for dropping out, but for offering the opportunity up. And make sure you check out Matt's podcast. He actually has two now. He's got the Rambling Runner, where he follows dedicated amateur runners, and then the Road to the Olympic Trials, which has been a great second project for him. He's been tracking people like Lindsay as they pursue their Olympic dreams. You can follow the Dying to Ask podcast on Instagram at Dying to Ask Podcast, or you can follow me at Run, Read, Sip. Thank you so much for joining me with us today. It's been really great to chat with you, and I'm a huge fan of your work, and I can't wait to see what you do next.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, Lindsay, and thanks again this week for listening to Dying to Ask. We'll see you again next week.
Thank you.